Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
To the Tidbit, brought to you by Curate. We are live at the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C. I'm your host and the CEO of Curate, Kim Bryden. Do you run a small business or have dreams to start one? Well, here at the Tidbit, we've got your back. Each week, we talk through tidbits of knowledge around starting or running a small business with a food and beverage lens. And as always, we jump off each show of the Tidbit with a little tidbit of knowledge on what I've been reading, listening to, or learning. And this is derived from a biweekly newsletter that we send out at Curate. We actually have a send going out this week, so if you're interested, head over to curate.co to sign up. In it, we discuss what we're reading, eating, drinking, listening to, and learning. Five quick morsels of information to get you in the know and on top of your game. So, in years past, many food and beverage entrepreneurs got their start at farmers markets. And while this is still true, there's been this big shift in the way food and beverage businesses are starting up in this era, and it's through the abundance of food halls. In this publication, The New Food Economy, they wrote a piece titled, "At this food hall, public space comes first, vendors order collectively, and employees are trained to work at any counter." Now, anyone who is familiar with food halls knows that there's typically some tension between those who are operating the space and those who are renting the space. So I was really interested to learn more about this particular food hall with such a positive headline. So the article goes on to read, "New concepts are only as good as their profits, which in restaurants are notoriously slim. John Kolaski has retooled the parts of the dining out that customers never see to improve the odds of its success. Mingling is the guiding principle here, as well as in the public space. The vendors at Social Eats operate collectively, not competitively. Food halls typically are multiple vendors," says Kolaski, "all fighting for the guest who walks in the front door. They're not working together to bring more guests into the space. They're working in silos. So at Social Eats, employees are trained to work at any of the counters. If there's a rush on tacos, someone who's working the sushi counter can step over and fill in, which reduces the need to call someone in on their day off and risk having to pay overtime. There's also a commissary kitchen where employees handle prep, cold dishes, and other menu items that are then finished at the counter. One operator has a lot of shared operational infrastructure, and it's the most interesting experiment happening on the promenade right now." Well, looks like I need to make a trip to Santa Monica to do some deeper digging into this. I'm so interested if you, listener, have ever been there, or if there are any food halls you admire, not necessarily based on the food options, but based on how they're run. This is really interesting to me. And more so, a piece that really stood out to me in this article, it starts actually at the top of the article stating, "To make way for the edible upgrade, the city issued a one-year ban on fast food operations with more than 100 outlets." That is actually the crux of what I want to talk about today on this episode. How are cities and municipalities rethinking their economic development, this real estate development of spaces for this change in consumer behavior? And why do we need to, as entrepreneurs, look at this new trend emerging? How do we fit in? How do we really think about this new systems change? So today, we are joined by Neil Takemoto. Neil has a 27-year career in sustainable urban planning and impact real estate development. He is the founder of CSPM Group, a crowdsourced placemaking firm that engaged 10,000 residents in the revitalization of several downtowns in partnership with developers, investors, and municipalities. He manages a global network of organizations and impact investors developing a scalable platform for community-capitalized real estate development. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back with Neil. You're listening to The Tidbit. I'm your show host and the CEO of Curate, Kim Bryden. We are chatting systems change with Neil Takemoto, founder of CSPM Group, a crowdsourced placemaking firm that, I'm still going to say this because it's remarkable, that's engaged 10,000 residents in the revitalization of several downtowns in partnership with developers, investors, and municipalities. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Kim.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, great to be here, just a few blocks from where I live.
Oh, perfect. I love, love, love the work you're doing, and it's one of my favorite topics to talk about, so let's jump into it.
Yeah.
Your firm, CSPM Group, it stands for Crowdsourced Placemaking, and you've developed this methodology that generates collective impact and investment in partnership with the local community, municipalities, and private sector developers and investors, which, like I just said, is very remarkable. So I'm wondering if you can tell us more about your background and provide an example of your work to illustrate how you approach this crowdsourced placemaking for any listener who might not know what that really entails.
Sure. My background comes in, educationally, architecture and business. And from there, my interests were in understanding cities and urban development, urban planning, which there really wasn't at the time much education for. So I kind of really dove into it from a environmental, sustainable point of city point of view. And the more I sort of understood the ins and outs of city planning and urban development and walkable communities and car-free places, and I realized that the institutional structure for that was not ready for that, or even close, but the people were. So the thought going through my head was always being sort of the problem-solving kind of mindset is, how can we accelerate that? And it really was about how do we take the people and define them as a group of customers that would actually help define the market to make it easier for investors and developers. Easier said than done. But when crowdsourcing was sort of, quote, invented or coined the term in 2006, that was where, like, that's it. That's the movement that is going to take us to the point where people have enough of the self-organization to actually form partnerships with developers and investors.
So coalescing a group of citizens together around a desired outcome, and then how that becomes a large enough stakeholder group that people actually are listening.
Yeah.
As opposed to these like fragmented people that are just maybe one-off complaints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, there's developers always, their complaint is that they don't like the idea of involving the public because the whole system, the way it's set up, is you have public hearings once a month or every couple months, and then the loudest people show up and complain.
Right.
And no one has any fun. And a lot of the majority, you're not listening to the majority of the people. You're just listening to the loudest voices, and that's not a good system.
Sounds like a Yelp page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, and then the other way to look at it is you look at your investment dollars. If you want to invest in something, and you have $100 or $1,000 or more, what are your choices typically? Can you invest in your neighborhood? No, but it's really easy to invest in the largest multinational companies in the world, right? E-Trade, just buy there and done. It's over, and you can track that in a portfolio. But if you want to buy shares in any kinds of local businesses or local real estate development, it's only the accredited investors, basically the 1%, are allowed to do that, and that's really messed up.
That is really messed up.
Yeah. So finally, that's shifting. Finally, there are platforms that are just coming around because of the Jobs Act a few years ago that allowed risk to be taken on by regular people versus just, quote, the rich people who could afford to lose money.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what about everyday folks that could afford to risk 100 or 200 to support their neighborhood? That platform did not exist, was not legal.
Yeah.
And so that's Yeah, I mean, there's many crazy things that were you know, that are illegal because of the way we built things in a mass production format that
right.
served big business.
Yeah, this post-World War II industrialized global efficient economy we've set up.
Yeah, like one quick example is as a developer, you can't build housing without parking. So if you have residents that don't have cars and just walk everywhere, they have to build parking. There's a lot of silly things that are old models.
And why? Because obviously there are things like car shares now, there's bike shares, but for some reason we still need to have parking lots.
Right.
When will that change?
So that's slowly changing because again, and it's primarily because the markets, the people are starting to self-organize and say, you know, we want to be the buyers or the renters here, and we don't need parking. And please stop making these developers put parking in because it's going to make the project unaffordable or not even possible.
Wow. You know, Neil and I were talking right before the show about having mutual connections. And what I want to bring up as well is I am friends with Jeff Speck, who writes about walkable cities. So yeah. I've learned a lot about over the years how there are these certain regulations and procedures we need to keep our eyes on because it is affecting the way we live and work in spaces. So interesting. Yeah. So with your work at this intersection of government, public sector, and also these private sector developers, where do you see urban planning and this placemaking trend moving in D.C., but also mm-hmm. across the United States? Where do you see this emerging?
So, and actually emerging is a great word because it's the current systems we have are institutional. So it's like when you look around at anything built post-1940s, it's largely very block-sized buildings. Mm. I mean, no one looks at a building as a beautiful icon of the neighborhood that was built after the 1940s because it's everything after that was built through systems. Uh-huh. It wasn't, you know, if you look at the most desirable neighborhoods, they were all built in the 1920s and 30s when craftsmanship was still sort of the norm of way we built neighborhoods. Georgetown, DuPont Circle, all these beautiful neighborhoods. There are all these, you know, historic homes. Mm-hmm. But it's not because they're historic that they're valuable. It's because they're human scale.
Right.
Right. And so they were financed by people at a human scale. Once our financing mechanisms went institutional or went sort of on a machine scale, risk analyzed sort of a construct, then that's when the building sort of reflected that.
Mm.
And so what thankfully is happening because of the internet and the democratization of participation, now people are able to self-organize and organize themselves as a market.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, even like with Uber and Airbnb becoming the market. Mm. So, you know, you don't hear about the CEOs of Airbnb and or maybe Uber for a little bit for other reasons. But like they're not telling you what to do. You're not hearing about what their day-to-day decisions are. It's the people, the market that's making the day-to-day decisions. And here in D.C., when you talk about real estate development, you only hear about the developers, right? The CEOs.
Yes,
everything.
Right.
It's what is that developer thing or this developer thing? And that's going to shift too.
Mm.
Where, you know, I hate to tell them that, but like they're going to be shifting down towards being the same roles that, say, contractors play, where you don't hear about the contractor. They're just there to serve the developer when the future developers are going to be serving the people.
Wow. Fascinating. So how does this shift begin? I mean, how do we self-organize to, I don't know, speak truth to power.
yeah. One is that actually, it's the way we've done it in our neighborhoods in New York. And ironically, and there's a hope with the way we did it, is that the developers actually sponsored these coalitions.
Mm.
Because they were talking about, these are large scale projects of like 20 or 30 acres in the downtown that was underprivileged communities. So they needed to actually listen to the people. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be able to step foot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to invest in listening to community. And so that was my role of forming coalitions of between 1 to 3,000 people. And then they self-named themselves as a coalition, Bristol Rising or Renew Hempstead or In Our Future. And basically formed monthly meetings and online support groups. And they started throwing out ideas that they want to see, and we helped them craft them into visually represented with description, with descriptions, and posting them, and then people would upvote the ones they'd support, from mobility to public spaces to local businesses, and then from that from all those, the top votes, we put them into the development plan that became
the master
law,
plan.
Right, that became law in the city.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and then you know, there's a few things that were like, there were some incentives that, like, if you wanted to have one or two stories, and you had to put in one of the public community serving amenities that were in that survey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, this is just, to me, the first generation of this.
Yes.
The second generation, which is what I'm working on, is where we actually have a system where the individual stories of everyone that lives there can be told in a narrative, and then those narratives can be collected by the thousands, and then visually represented so we can see the aligned interest, and people can self-organize around that.
Oh my gosh. We are going to get into this second phase in just a minute, but I want to comment on what I just heard you say, because I've been a part of a few master development conversations over the past couple of years. And to me, when these conversations are emerging, just reflecting back what I heard, there are a very few stakeholders around the table. There are these maybe monthly hearings, like, let's hear from the community.
Yeah.
But it's just a loudest voice in the room a lot of times. And the economic development strategy is, let's bring in one major tenant or one major anchor thing, and that's going to create X amount of jobs. And I have always said, what jobs are actually being created, though, especially for the individuals who you say you're serving? Are they janitorial? Are they admin? Are those even jobs that the people of the community want? Like, did anybody ask anyone? Like, what types of places one would want to be employed, or what types of skill sets people are looking to learn and lean into more? So I think that is so fascinating, and being able to actually create data sets around what people are actually desiring in their community. So thank you for sharing that and for just doing the work. Let's take a quick break, and then I want to get into this second phase of what you're talking about. Okay, quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Tidbit. I'm Kim Bryden, your host and the CEO of Curate. We are here with Neil Takemoto, the founder of CSPM Group. So, Neil, in a blog post you recently penned titled "Co-Creating Places Start with Collecting Stories, Sense Making," you wrote, "A community's health is often measured by explicit outcomes, for example, income, jobs, crime, over intrinsic outcomes, for example, belonging, compassion, leadership, resulting in a dominance of investment in those explicit outcomes. This one-sided investment severely inhibits meaningful growth in intrinsic outcomes, inhibiting extrinsic outcomes as well. The problem is, how does one even begin to measure intrinsic outcomes, much less invest in them?" This is a great question.
Yep.
Neil.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does one even begin to measure outcomes that are typically, I would say, not upheld by our current society as benchmarks of success?
Right.
And how can small business owners also uphold these metrics? I feel like small business owners are the first to maybe effectuate change.
Yeah. You want the fun, provocative answer to that question?
I love provocative answers. Yeah. And also, yes. Give it to me.
So, so how do you measure these outcomes? Burning Man is Burning Man is this crowdsourced city of 70,000 people,
mm-hmm.
right? So, it has all these other things you read about, it's people having too much fun, but like what it is really a crowdsourced city of 70,000 people.
If a listener has never heard of Burning Man,
yeah.
do you have any more to share as to like what it is?
It really is. It's
a pop-up city.
Yeah, it's a pop-up city. And what's beautiful about it is that it's a great laboratory for understanding if 70,000 people created their own city, how would that function?
Mm.
And the fact that it gets so many positive transformations from people coming back, and there's no Wi-Fi, there's no internet, there's no actually exchange of money, everything's gifting. So it's just an experiment in terms of like, if people were at their on their best behavior in a mutually beneficial mindset, how would that function and look and feel? So it's a really great study. So actually there's a lot of interesting models of like local business there where they actually created, recreated, I just learned this, they just recreated the Golden Guy District in Japan, which is this very intimate series of small 10-foot stalls that become six-person bars. And that's, it's become like the hangout spot in Tokyo. And when I visited there a couple of years ago, it's like, why don't we have more of these in the U.S.? And then Burning Man, they actually started creating that spontaneously amongst themselves 2 or 3 years ago. And now it's gone from 6 to 50 of these stalls. And I'm thinking, that's the way we're going to model this and build these places. And it really supports small business because you can start a business in a 10-foot stall, square, and have a small customer base and experiment and grow from there. And then when you actually create a scene of others in a mutually beneficial way. So, I mean, that's not what I was going to mention in Burning Man, but I, while I was there, talking about co-creation models with someone from the administration of the organization, and I, they handed me a paper, said, here, you need to look at this. And it was a paper on measuring social impact. And the crux of the paper, after 3 hours of reading it over and over again, because it's a very dense paper, is it said that effective social impact accounting happens when the people are actually doing the social impact accounting. And I had to read that over and over again because I didn't quite know what that meant. But it's like, if you're, if first of all, what are you measuring that's healthy in a neighborhood? You know, you have people from the outside that come in and measure, versus like the people will tell you, no, I can tell you what, you know, a healthy neighborhood is, and but no one ever asked them.
Right.
And then not only that, if you ask them what makes a healthy neighborhood and they come up with their criteria, but they're the ones also measuring it on a regular basis, then just by those acts alone, you will have a greater amount of social impact because they're now aware and measuring collectively what's going on in your neighborhood. So
they're so not complacent to just moving about through life.
Yeah.
It's taking an active role.
Yeah.
I mean, macro level, one could say at times when presidents or otherwise are saying like, the stock market's up, but then all of us are like, what does that matter for me?
Right. I mean, how does that apply to me? So what are, you know, what are the criteria that really means success for a local business or a series of local businesses? And so once they come out with the criteria, and then they're the ones who set that criteria and said, we need support from the administration or the municipality or developers to meet these outcomes. So they're the ones that are defining it. And what are they? That's up to them to decide. But once they define it, then everything revolves around that versus the other way around. We're saying, well, this is what you need to do.
There's a very interesting woman. I don't follow her that closely, but her name is Danielle Laporte, and she came up with this idea around, instead of New Year's resolutions, it's called core desired feelings. So you might say your resolution is lose weight, but why do you want to lose weight? Is the ultimate outcome is that you want to feel more confident. And that way, the thing you should be looking for is, how do I achieve confidence this year?
Right.
It's not about the losing weight.
Right.
And so as you're talking about this, it's making me think, again, these intrinsic outcomes, belonging, connection.
Right.
Are you just saying or pretending to attribute the idea of like job creation to those outcomes as opposed to looking the opposite way and saying like, no, people want to feel like they belong.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And take it one step further. It's like when you ask your customers, because, you know, you ask any local business, that's where it starts. And said, what outcomes are you looking for? They're not going to say jobs. You know, I don't come to your business to support jobs. I mean, you know, per se, not, you know, most people will not say jobs or income or tax generation. That's not why support your business. It's like, I want to feel like supporting the local community. I want to feel like a sense of belonging. I want to feel a sense of friendship or connection. Those are the intrinsic outcomes they're looking for. So you actually go one step further and measure that of your customer base. What are the intrinsic outcomes they're seeking? And then you build your business around those.
Yes.
And then you ask for support from the top, saying we need to support these intrinsic outcomes. And we're all measuring, the customer base, the business, they're all measuring this together. Then you shifted everything over towards what people really care about and having a role in shaping that versus having these extrinsic outcomes at the top that no one really cares about.
Right. And ultimately, by serving that feeling, that intrinsic outcome, you probably will make more money.
Yeah.
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 I think about the bars and restaurants I frequent the most, and it's because when I go there, I feel taken care of. Like, the food and drink can be delicious, but the ones I go back to over and over again is because I feel seen and heard and someone's taking care of me.
That's
how I feel.
Absolutely.
And that's so much the hospitality industry that I don't know that people always can put their finger on.
Right. Well, along those lines, there's a concept of mutually benefiting qualities that is sustainable. Like, say you take sort of a Darwin sort of study, and they'll say, like, the people who are altruistic or self-sacrificing, and that's not sustainable, that's not going to create viral growth, or just the opposite, spiteful people who take people down, that's not sustainable. The two types that are sustainable, unfortunately, one is a selfish type, because they're basically looking out for themselves, so they're going to multiply because they're only looking out for themselves. And you can't fight that with altruism, because that's not sustainable. The only other type that's going to actually compete with that is the mutually beneficial type. Because then they can actually involve people to compete with the selfish. And so that's why the food hall is a great example of the mutually beneficial model that's able to compete with the multinationals.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're basically forming a larger group of a larger customer base, a larger vendor and supplier base, a larger entrepreneurial base that is larger and more intrinsically connected than
a McDonald's.
One. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Oh, wow. Great tie back to the beginning tidbit. but I do want to think about this more macro level for a second, because a lot of small business owners are worried about month over month cash flow. I mean, that's just a given. And at times, people can't even project into the future far enough to see what's coming down the road in terms of policy updates and regulations and where these, again, trends are moving. So I guess I'm wondering, can you tell us, what do you believe cities or municipalities are looking for? And what opportunities do you see coming down the pipeline for small business owners to fill in this shift in the way we're designing our spaces?
Right. Well, just so what municipalities are looking for, I mean, they're looking for, you know, economic dollars. They're looking for ways that how to, you know, something as a cynical overview of what an economic development department does is steal other people's companies, steal other cities' companies.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, and that's what economic development is. It's like, how do we get, you know, companies to move here? Well, then they're moving from somewhere else. That's
Amazon HQ2 bid.
Exactly. It's a zero sum gain. And what the other term that's sort of burgeoning is economic gardening. How do we grow local businesses so that there's a net positive, right? But that's something that's not very.
I love this.
Yeah.
Economic gardening.
Yeah. So it's a term that's there's a group that there's an economic gardening group coalition, but it's something that a lot of municipalities are not very good at, often because it's like, you know, the administration is steeped in policy but not in actually entrepreneurialism. So that's something they need a little help in. And this is why small businesses need to form coalitions, whether through a bid or through a network, or like Think Local First here in D.C.
Mm-hmm. A bid is a business improvement district.
Yes, absolutely, and that's a mutually beneficial organization.
Mm-hmm.
And also to like network and actually share resources like Curate does with your company to compete with the larger groups. And so they need to actually really focus on the mutually beneficial gene of survival. So, and then the part that's kind of new is that to form there's a word called inclusive stakeholding, and there's a book called Interdependent Capitalism that actually really gets to the heart of everything I'm talking about.
Great.
But it's like, how do you then take that inclusive stakeholding mindset to your customer base? And that's kind of new.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's the thing with the sense making and storytelling and way to capture thousands of people's stories. That's where that all starts to fit in.
I am going to the library and acquiring this book or an independent bookstore.
That's right, exactly.
So if anyone wants to find out more about you, reach out, work with you any which way, how can people go about finding you on the internet?
Yeah. Okay. So cspmgroup.com is the website.
Mm-hmm.
You can email me at neil@cspmgroup.com.
Great.
And that should do it.
Amazing. Thank you for being here today. So listeners, we would love if more budding entrepreneurs could find out about the tidbit. Our mission at Curate has always included the sharing of education and access to resources. And the best way to reach more folks like you is to, leave a review in iTunes. I would be so appreciative if you could head over to your app, leave a little tidbit on there about what you've learned here on the show today, and also send us an email. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your feedback, what topics you'd like us to explore. And until next time, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.